Part 6. Discover Why. Chapter 13. The Origins of a Why. It started in Vietnam War-era Northern California, where anti-government ideals and disdain for large centers of power ran rampant. Two young men saw the power of government and corporations as the enemy, not because they were big per se, but because they squashed the spirit of the individual. They imagined a world in which an individual had a voice. They imagined a time when an individual could successfully stand up to incumbent power, old assumptions, and status quo thoughts, and successfully challenge them, even redirect them. They hung out with hippie types who shared their beliefs, but they saw a different way to change the world that didn't require protesting or engaging in anything illegal. Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs came of age in this time. Not only was the revolutionary spirit running high in Northern California, but it was also the time and place of the computer revolution. And in this technology, they saw the opportunity to start their own revolution. The Apple gave an individual the power to do the same things as any company, Wozniak recounts. For the first time ever, Wozniak goes on, one person could take on a corporation simply because they had the ability to use technology. Wozniak engineered the Apple I and later the Apple II to be simple enough for people to harness the power of the technology. Jobs knew how to sell it. Thus was born Apple Computer, a company with a purpose: to give the individual, to give the dreamers and the idealists the power to challenge the status quo and succeed. But their cause, their why, started long before Apple was ever born. In 1971, working out of Wozniak's dorm room at UC Berkeley, the two Steves made something they called the Blue Box. Their little device hacked the phone system to give people the ability to avoid paying long-distance rates on their phone bills. Apple Computers didn't exist yet, but Jobs and Woz were already challenging a Big Brother-type power, in this case, Ma Bell, American Telephone and Telegraph, the monopoly phone company. Technically, what the Blue Box did was illegal, and with no desire to challenge power by breaking the law, Jobs and Woz never actually used the device themselves. But they liked the idea of giving other individuals the ability to avoid having to play by the rules of monopolistic forces, a theme that would repeat many more times in Apple's future. On April 1, 1976, they repeated their pattern again. They took on the giants of the computer industry, most notably Big Blue, IBM. Before Apple, computing still meant using a punch card to give instructions to a huge mainframe squirreled away in a computer center somewhere. IBM targeted their technology to corporations and not, as Apple intended, as a tool for individuals to target corporations. With clarity of purpose and amazing discipline, Apple Computer's success seemed to follow the law of diffusion, almost by design. In its first year in business, the company sold $1 million worth of computers to those who believed what they believed. By year two, they had sold $10 million worth. By their third year in business, they were $100 million company, and they had attained billion-dollar status within only 6 years. Already a household name, in 1984, Apple launched the Macintosh with their famed 1984 commercial that aired during the Super Bowl. Directed by Ridley Scott, famed director of cult classics like Blade Runner, the commercial also changed the course of advertising. The first Super Bowl commercial was born. It ushered in the annual tradition of big-budget, cinematic Super Bowl advertising. With the Macintosh, Apple once again changed the tradition of how things were done. They challenged the standard of Microsoft's DOS, the standard operating system used by most personal computers at the time. The Macintosh was the first mass-market computer to use a graphical user interface and a mouse, allowing people to simply point and click, rather than input code. Ironically, it was Microsoft that took Apple's concept to the masses with Windows, Gates' version of the graphical user interface. Apple's ability to ignite revolutions and Microsoft's ability to take ideas to the mass market perfectly illustrate the why of each company, and indeed their respective founders. Jobs has always been about challenge, and Gates has always been about getting to the most people. Apple would continue to challenge with other products that followed the same pattern. Recent examples include the iPod, and more significantly, iTunes. With these technologies, Apple challenged the status quo business model of the music industry, an industry so distracted trying to protect its intellectual property and their outdated business model that it was busy suing 13-year-old music pirates while Apple redefined the online music market. The pattern repeated again when Apple introduced the iPhone. The status quo dictated that the cellular providers, not the phone manufacturer, decided the features and capability of the actual phones. T-Mobile, Verizon Wireless, and Sprint, for example, tell Motorola, LG, and Nokia what to do. Apple changed all that when they announced that with the iPhone, they would be telling the provider what the phone would do. Ironically, the company that Apple challenged with their blue box decades before, this time around, exhibited classic early adopter behavior. AT&T was the only one to agree to this new model, and so another revolution was ignited. Apple's keen aptitude for innovation is born out of its why, and save for the few years that Jobs was missing, it has never changed since the company was founded. Industries holding on to legacy business models should be forewarned. You could be next. If Apple stays true to their why, the television and movie industries will likely be next. Apple's ability to do what they do has nothing to do with industry expertise. All computer and technology companies have open access to talent and resources and are just as qualified to produce all the products that Apple does. It has to do with a purpose, cause, or belief that started many years ago with a couple of idealists in Cupertino, California. I want to put a ding in the universe, as Steve Jobs put it, and that's exactly what Apple does in the industries in which it competes. Apple is born out of its founder's why. There is no difference between one or the other. Apple is just one of the whats to Jobs's and Woz's why. The personality of Jobs and Apple are exactly the same. In fact, the personalities of all those who are viscerally drawn to Apple are similar. There is no difference between an Apple customer and an Apple employee. One believes in Apple's why and chooses to work for the company, and the other believes in Apple's why and chooses to buy its products. It is just a behavioral difference. Loyal shareholders are no different either. What they buy is different, but the reason they buy and remain loyal is the same. The products of the company become the symbols of their own identities. The diehards outside the company are said to be a part of the cult of Apple. The diehards inside the company are said to be a part of the cult of Steve. Their symbols are different, but their devotion to the cause is the same. That we use the word cult implies that we can recognize that there is deep faith, something irrational, that all those who believe share. And we'd be right. Jobs, his company, his loyal employees, and his loyal customers all exist to push the boundaries. They all fancy a good revolution. Just because Apple's why is so clear does not mean everyone is drawn to it. Some people like them and some people don't. Some people embrace them and some are repelled by them. But it cannot be denied. They stand for something. The law of diffusion says that only 2.5% of the population has the innovator mentality. They are the group of people willing to trust their intuition and take greater risks than others. Perhaps it's no coincidence that Microsoft Windows sits on 96% of the world's computers, whereas Apple maintains about 2.5%. Most people don't want to challenge the status quo. Although Apple employees will tell you that the company's success lies in its products, the fact is that a lot of companies make quality products. And though Apple's employees may still insist that their products are better, it depends on the standard by which you are judging them. Apple's products are indeed best for those who relate to Apple's why. It is Apple's belief that comes through in all that they think and all that they say and do that makes them who they are. They're so effective at it that they're actually able to clearly identify their own products simply by preceding the product name with the letter I. But they don't just own the letter I, they own the word I. They are a company that champions the creative spirit of the individual, and their products, services, and marketing simply prove it. The why comes from looking back. Conservative estimates put the numbers at 3-1. But some historians have said that the English army was outnumbered by 6-1. Regardless of which estimates you choose to believe, the prospects for Henry V, King of England, did not look good. It was late October in the year 1415, and the English army stood ready to do battle against a much bigger French force at Agincourt in northern France. But the numbers were just one of Henry's problems. The English army had marched over 250 miles. Taking them nearly 3 weeks, they had also lost 40% of their original numbers to sickness. The French, in stark contrast, were better rested and in much better spirits. The better trained and more experienced French were also excited at the prospect of exacting their revenge on the English to make up for the humiliation of previous defeats. And to top it all off, the French were vastly better equipped. The English were lightly armored, but whatever protection they did have was no match for the superior weight of French armor. But anyone who knows their medieval European history already knows the outcome of the Battle of Agincourt. Despite the overwhelming odds, the English won. The English had one vital piece of technology that was able to confound the French and start a chain of events that would ultimately result in a French defeat. The English had the longbow, a weapon with astounding range for its time. Standing far from the battlefield, far enough away that heavy armor was not needed, the English could look down into the valley and shower the French with arrows. But technology and range aren't what give an arrow its power. By itself, an arrow is a flimsy stick of wood with a sharpened tip and some feathers. By itself, an arrow cannot stand up to a sword or penetrate armor. What gives the arrow the ability to take on experience, training, numbers, and armor is momentum. That flimsy stick of wood, when hurtling through the air, becomes a force only when it is moving fast in one direction. But what does the Battle of Agincourt have to do with finding your why? Before it can gain any power or achieve any impact, an arrow must be pulled backward 180 degrees from the target. And that's also where a why derives its power. The why does not come from looking ahead at what you want to achieve and figuring out an appropriate strategy to get there. It is not born out of any market research. It does not come from extensive interviews with customers or even employees. It comes from looking in the completely opposite direction from where you are now. Finding why is a process of discovery, not invention. Just as Apple's why developed during the rebellious 1960s and 70s, the why for every other individual or organization comes from the past. It is born out of the upbringing and life experience of an individual or small group. Every single person has a why, and every single organization has one too. An organization, don't forget, is one of the what's, one of the tangible things a founder or group of founders has done in their lives to prove their why. Every company, organization, or group with the ability to inspire starts with a person or small group of people who are inspired to do something bigger than themselves. Gaining clarity of why, ironically, is not the hard part. It is the discipline to trust one's gut, to stay true to one's purpose, cause, or beliefs. Remaining completely in balance and authentic is the most difficult part. The few that are able to build a megaphone around their cause, and not just a company, are the ones who earn the ability to inspire. In doing so, they harness a power to move people that few can even imagine. Learning the why of a company or an organization, or understanding the why of any social movement, always starts with one thing: you. I am a failure. There are 3 months indelibly printed in my memory. September to December 2005. This was when I hit rock bottom. I started my business in February 2002, and it was incredibly exciting. I was full of piss and vinegar, as my grandfather would say. From an early age, my goal was to start my own business. It was the American dream, and I was living it. My whole feeling of self-worth came from the fact that I did it. I took the plunge, and it felt amazing. If anyone ever asked me what I did, I would pose like George Reeves from the old Superman TV series, I would put my hands on my hips, stick out my chest, and stand at an angle. With my head raised high, I'd declare, I am an entrepreneur. What I did was how I defined myself, and it felt good. I wasn't like Superman. I was Superman. As anyone who starts a business knows, it is a fantastic race. There is a statistic that hangs over your head. Over 90% of all new businesses fail in the first 3 years. For anyone with even a bit of a competitive spirit in them, especially for someone who defines himself or herself as an entrepreneur, hands on hips, chest out, standing at an angle, these overwhelming odds of failure are not intimidating. They only add fuel to the fire. The foolishness of thinking that you're part of a small minority of those who actually will make it past 3 years and defy the odds is part of what makes entrepreneurs who they are, driven by passion and completely irrational. After year one, we celebrated. We hadn't gone out of business. We were beating the odds. We were living the dream. 2 years passed, then three. I'm still not sure how we did it. We never properly implemented any good systems and processes, but to heck with it, we'd beaten the odds, and I had achieved the goal, and that's all that mattered. I was now a proud member of a very small group of people who could say, with statistical proof, that I was an American small business owner. The fourth year would prove to be very different. The novelty of being an entrepreneur had worn off. I no longer stood like George Reeves. When asked what I did, I would now tell people that I did positioning and strategy consulting. It was much less exciting, and it certainly didn't feel like a big race anymore. It was no longer a passionate pursuit. It was just a business. And the reality was that the business did not look that rosy. We were never a runaway success. We made a living, but not much more. We had some Fortune 500 clients, and we did good work. I was crystal clear on what we did. And I could tell you how we were different and how we did it. Like everyone else in the game, I would try to convince prospective clients how we did it, how we were better, how we were unique. And it worked. The truth is, we beat the odds because of my energy, not because of my business acumen. But I didn't have the energy to sustain that strategy for the rest of my life. I was aware enough to know that we needed better systems and processes if this business was going to sustain itself. I was incredibly demoralized. Intellectually, I could tell you what I needed to do. I just couldn't do it. By December 2005, I was the closest I've ever been to if I wasn't already completely depressed. My whole life, I'd been a pretty happy-go-lucky guy, so just being unhappy was bad enough. But this was worse. The depression made me paranoid. I was convinced I was going to go out of business. I was convinced I was going to be evicted from my apartment. I was certain that anyone who worked for me didn't like me, and that my clients knew I was a fraud. I thought everyone I met was smarter than me. I thought everyone I met was better than me. And any energy I had left to sustain the business now went into propping myself up and pretending that I was doing well. If things were to change, I knew I needed to learn to implement more structure before everything crashed. I attended conferences, I read books, and I asked successful friends for advice on how to do it. It was all good advice, but I couldn't hear it. No matter what I was told, all I could hear was that I was doing everything wrong. Trying to fix the problem didn't make me feel better. It made me feel worse. I felt more helpless. I started having desperate thoughts, thoughts that, for an entrepreneur, are almost worse than suicide. I thought about getting a job. Anything. Anything that would stop the feeling of falling I had almost every day. I remember visiting the family of my future brother-in-law for Thanksgiving that year. I sat on the couch in the living room of his mother's house. People were talking to me, but I never heard a word. I was asked questions. I replied only in platitudes. I didn't really desire or even have the ability to make conversation anymore. It was then that I realized the truth. Statistics notwithstanding, I was a failure. As an anthropology major in college and a strategy guy in the marketing and advertising world, I had always been curious about why people do the things they do. Early in my career, I started becoming curious about these same themes in the real world. In my case, corporate marketing. There's an old saying in the industry that 50% of all marketing works. The problem is, which 50%? I was always astounded that so many companies would operate with such a level of uncertainty. Why would anyone want to leave the success of something that costs so much, with so much at stake, to the flip of a coin? I was convinced that if some marketing worked, it was possible to figure out why. All companies of equal resources have equal access to the same agencies, the same talent, and the same media. So why does some marketing work and some doesn't? Working in an ad agency, I'd seen it all the time. With conditions relatively equal, the same team could develop a campaign that would be hugely successful one year, then develop something the next year that would do nothing. Instead of focusing on the stuff that didn't work, I chose to focus on the stuff that did, to find out what it all had in common. The good news for me was there wasn't that much to study. How has Apple been able to so consistently outmarket their competition over and over and over? What was Harley Davidson doing so well that they were able to create a following of people so loyal that they would tattoo a corporate logo on their bodies? Why did people love Southwest Airlines so much? They aren't really that special, are they? In an attempt to codify why these worked, I developed a simple concept I called the Golden Circle. But my theory sat buried on my computer files. It was just a little pet project with no real application, just something I found interesting. It would be months later that I met a woman at an event who took interest in my perspectives in marketing. Victoria Duffy Hopper grew up in an academic family and also has a lifelong fascination with human behavior. She was the first to tell me about the limbic brain and the neocortex. My curiosity piqued by what she was telling me, I started reading about the biology of the human brain, and it was then that I made the real discovery. The biology of human behavior and the golden circle overlapped perfectly. While I was trying to understand why some marketing worked and why some didn't, I had tripped over something vastly more profound. I discovered why people do what they do. It was then that I realized what the real cause of my stress was. The problem wasn't that I didn't know what to do or how to do it. The problem was I'd forgotten why. I had gone through what I now know is a split, and I needed to rediscover my why. To inspire people to do the things that inspire them. Henry Ford said, "If you think you can, or you think you can't, you're right." He was a brilliant why guy who changed the way industry works. A man who embodied all the characteristics of a great leader, who understood the importance of perspective. I wasn't any dumber than I was when I started my business, probably the opposite, in fact. What I had lost was perspective. I knew what I was doing, but I had forgotten why. There is a difference between running with all your heart with your eyes closed and running with all your heart with your eyes wide open. For 3 years, my heart had pounded, but my eyes had been closed. I had passion and energy, but I lacked focus and direction. I needed to remember what inspired my passion. I became obsessed with the concept of why. I was consumed by the idea of it. It was all I talked about. When I looked back at my upbringing, I discovered a remarkable thing. Whether among my friends at school or professionally, I was always the eternal optimist. I was the one who inspired everyone to believe that they could do whatever they wanted. This pattern is my why, to inspire. It didn't matter if I was doing it in marketing or consulting. It didn't matter what types of companies I worked with or in which industries I worked. To inspire people to do the things that inspired them, so that together we can change the world. That's the path to which my life and my work is now completely devoted. Henry Ford would have been proud of me. After months of thinking I couldn't, now I knew I could. I made myself a guinea pig for this concept. If the reason I hit rock bottom was because my golden circle was out of balance, then I needed to get it back in balance. If it was important to start with why, then I would start with why in everything I did. There's not a single concept in this book that I don't practice. I stand at the mouth of my megaphone, and I talk about the why to anyone who will listen. Those early adopters who hear my cause see me as a tool in their arsenal to achieve their own why, and they introduced me to others whom they believed I could inspire, and so the law of diffusion started to do its job. Though the golden circle and the concept of why was working for me, I wanted to show it to others. I had a decision to make. Do I try to patent it, protect it, and use it to make lots of money, or do I give it away? This decision was to be my first celery test. My why is to inspire people to do the things that inspire them. And if I am to be authentic to that cause, there was only one decision to make, to give it away, to talk about it, to share it. There would never be any secret sauce or special formula for which only I knew the ingredients. The vision is to have every person and every organization know their why and use it to benefit all they do. So that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. I'm relying entirely on the concept of why and the naturally occurring pattern that is the golden circle to help me get there. The experiment started to work. Prior to starting with why, I had been invited to give one public speech my whole life. Now, I get 30 and 40 invitations per year from all sorts of audiences all over the world to speak about the golden circle. I speak to audiences of entrepreneurs, large corporations, nonprofits. I speak in politics and in government. I've spoken at the Pentagon to the Chief of Staff and the Secretary of the Air Force. Prior to the Golden Circle, I didn't even know anyone in the military. Prior to starting with Y, I had never been on television. In fewer than 2 years, I started getting regular invitations to appear on MSNBC. I've worked with members of Congress, having never done any government or political work prior to starting with Y. I'm the same person. I know the same things I did before. The only difference is now I start with why. Like Gordon Bethune, who turned around Continental with the same people and the same equipment, I was able to turn things around with the things I already knew and did. I'm not better connected than anyone else. I don't have a better work ethic. I don't have an Ivy League education, and my grades in college were average. The funny part is, I still don't know how to build a business. The only thing that I do that most people don't is that I learned how to start with why. Chapter 14, The New Competition. If you follow your why, then others will follow you. Bang! The gun fires and the race is on. The runners take off across the field. It rained the day before and the ground is still damp. The temperature is cool. It is a perfect day for running. The line of runners quickly forms a pack. Like a school of fish, they come together as one. They move as one. The pack sets a pace to maximize their energy for the whole race. As with any race, in a short period of time, the stronger ones will start to pull ahead and the weaker ones will start to fall behind. But not Ben Komen. Ben was left behind as soon as the starter gun sounded. Ben's not the fastest runner on the team. In fact, he's the slowest. He has never won a single race the entire time he's been on the Hanna High School cross-country team. Ben, you see, has cerebral palsy. Cerebral palsy, a condition often caused by complications at birth, affects someone's movements and balance. The physical problems endure for a lifetime. Misshapen spines create a twisted posture. Muscles are often withered and motor reflexes slow. Tightness in the muscles and joints also affect balance. Those with CP often have an unsteady gait. Their knees knock and their feet drag. To an outsider, they may seem clumsy or broken. The pack pulls farther and farther ahead, while Ben falls farther and farther behind. He slips on the wet grass and falls forward into the soft earth. He slowly picks himself up and keeps going. Down he goes again. This time it hurts. He gets up and keeps running. Ben won't quit. The pack is now out of sight, and Ben is running alone. It is quiet. He can hear only his own labored breathing. He feels lonely. He trips over his own feet again, and down he goes yet another time. No matter his mental strength, there is no hiding the pain and frustration on his face. He grimaces as he uses all his energy to pull himself back to his feet to continue running. For Ben, this is part of the routine. Everyone else finishes the race in about 25 minutes. it usually takes Ben more than 45 minutes. When Ben eventually crosses the finish line, he is in pain and he is exhausted. It took every ounce of strength he had to make it. His body is bruised and bloodied. He is covered in mud. Ben inspires us indeed. But this is not a story of when the going gets tough, the tough gets going. This is not a story of when you fall down, you pick yourself back up. Those are great lessons to learn, without a doubt. But we don't need Ben Komen to teach us those lessons. There are dozens of others we can look to for that. An Olympic athlete, for example, who suffered an injury just months before the games, only to come back to win a medal. Ben's lesson is deeper. Something amazing happens after about 25 minutes. When everybody else is done with their race, everyone else comes back to run with Ben. Ben is the only runner who, when he falls, there's someone there to help him back up. Ben is the only runner, when he finishes, has 100 people running behind him. What Ben teaches us is special. When you compete against everyone else, no one wants to help you. But when you compete against yourself, everyone wants to help you. Olympic athletes don't help each other. They're competitors. Ben starts every race with a clear sense of why he's running. He's not there to beat anyone but himself. Ben never loses sight of that. His sense of why he's running gives him the strength to keep going, to keep pushing, to keep getting up, to keep going and going, and to do it again and again and again. And every day he runs, the only time Ben sets out to beat is his own. Now think about how we do business. We're always competing against someone else. We're always trying to be better than someone else. Better quality, more features, better service, always comparing ourselves to others, and no one wants to help us. What if we showed up to work every day simply to be better than ourselves? What if the goal was to do better work this week than we did the week before, to make this month better than last month, for no other reason than because we want to leave the organization in a better state than we found it? All organizations start with why, but only the great ones keep their why clear year after year. Those who forget why they were founded show up to the race every day to outdo someone else instead of to outdo themselves. The pursuit, for those who lose sight of why they are running the race, is for the medal or to beat someone else. What if the next time someone asks you, "Who's your competition?" we replied, "No idea." What if the next time someone pushes, "Well, what makes you better than your competition?" we replied, "We're not better than them in all cases." And what if the next time someone asks, "Well, why should I do business with you then?" we answer with confidence, "Because the work we're doing now is better than the work we were doing 6 months ago, and the work we will be doing 6 months from this point will be better than the work we're doing today. Because we wake up every day with a sense of why we come to work. We come to work to inspire people to do the things that inspire them. Are we better than our competition? If you believe what we believe, and you believe that the things we do can help you, then yes, we're better. If you don't believe what we believe, and you don't believe the things we do can help you, then no, we're not better. Our goal is to find customers who believe what we believe and work together so that we can all succeed. We're looking for people to stand shoulder to shoulder with us in pursuit of the same goal. We're not interested in sitting across a table from each other in pursuit of a sweeter deal. And here are the things we're doing to advance our cause. And the details of how and what you do follow. But this time, it started with why. Imagine if every organization started with why. Decisions would be simpler, loyalties would be greater, trust would be a common currency. If our leaders were diligent about starting with why, optimism would reign and innovation would thrive. As this book illustrates, there is precedence for this standard. No matter the size of the organization, no matter the industry, no matter the product or the service, if we all take some responsibility to start with why and inspire others to do the same, then together we can change the world. And that's pretty inspiring. And a final note from me. If this book inspired you, please pass it on to someone that you want to inspire. Thank you.
This has been a Gildan Audio production. For more affordable, life-changing audio programs, visit our website at gildanmedia.com.